in my corner of the academic world are attuned to the many things that we don't know, for instance, about our contemporary times, about other times, about societies that we've never seen before. So there are large aspects of the unknown there. And you're saying that this is also true in the area of physics and the area of the sort of larger explanations and descriptions of the world and the universe.
Well, yes, indeed. So, I mean, there's two aspects of physics presently. There's the general relativity from Einstein, quantum mechanics from the other physicists, Schrödinger and Heisenberg. And they both say that the world isn't what you think it is, you know, from your daily activities. And the more radical one is the quantum mechanics. So you have a PhD in physics, so I've always enjoyed that end of describing, you know, the world. And the more you look into these theories, the sort of the stranger it gets. And it certainly hasn't, even though both of those theories, relativity was 1915, was basically when that was finished. And so that's over 100 years ago now. Quantum mechanics started in the 1920s. Got a lot of things right then, but it was developed over the coming decades. And in its present good as it can get format, quantum field theory was early 1970s was when that was finished. But it hasn't seeped into, you know, the general public's awareness, I don't believe, as to what really the implications are from either of those theories. So maybe there's things that can be learned from them. And some of the things, relativity is slightly less, you know, disturbing, I would say, as a theory of how matter works and how the world works and everything in it, because obviously we mustn't forget that, you know, human beings are, you know, made out of matter and that interacts with the world. So all of these theories of physics, you know, they apply to everything as far as a physicist is concerned. And so with relativity, usually you think of, okay, it makes a difference if you go at very high speed, you know, speeds near the speed of light, for example. But people don't usually go near the speed of light, so they don't get to see that. Or it makes a very big difference in strong gravitational fields, like near a black hole. But most of us don't live near a black hole. So again, we don't really see those effects particularly. It does have an implication as to, you know, what does the word now mean? So what's simultaneous? You know, something's happening over here at one time is what's happening over the other side of the world at the same time. So what does that even mean comes a little bit questionable under relativity. But again, it's, you know, the implications aren't necessarily too far out. Whereas if you go to quantum mechanics, there's a lot more radical change to how you might see the world.
And how would you see the world from a sort of quantum mechanics point of view?
Well, there's several aspects to it that one might say, you know, unintuitive. One is the freedom that exists in the universe. So usually you think, especially in physics, you know, you've got the laws of physics, and it says, you know, if you do this, then you do that, or that happens. And if you want a valid experiment, then you set up the experiment, you get a result, do the experiment again, you get the same result, do it again, you get the same result, and you think, you know, everything makes sense, okay, I know what is happening now. But, so quantum mechanics undermines that by saying, well, you can get different results from the same experiment, you do it two times in a row, you get different answers. And that's perfectly valid, legitimate, and in fact, it is the laws of physics that you will get different results. So what the laws now mean, they sort of change their meaning as to what is a law. So the way quantum mechanics does it, which had never been done before, basically, is to say that even if you start off, you know, in some condition, some known state at the beginning of, you know, time zero, that this can develop into different possible outcomes. And say you know, you start off in one state, but you can end up in two different states, which are very distinct from each other. They're obviously different. An example of this is very simple examples. If you have a light source, you know, emitting some light, and that light goes onto a piece of glass, so some of the light will transmit through the glass, you know, you see through glass. Some of the light will bounce off the glass because, you know, the partial reflections, you can see, you see your own reflection in a shop window. There's reflections from glass and there's transmission. So, and normally you don't worry about that. However, you do worry about it when you think of the smallest bit of light there is a photon. It's one particle of light. So that gets transmitted from the light source and it meets this piece of glass. So what does that one photon do? Does it go through or does it reflect? And according to, you can do all the maths and you can do the laws of physics and the laws of quantum mechanics. And what the laws tell you after you do all the maths and you go through all the equations is that sometimes it'll go through, sometimes it'll reflect. And there's what all your maths is doing is telling you what the probability is. So it'll transmit at 70% and reflect at 30%, for example. That's what your numbers are telling you. But it won't tell you which one it does. So if you arrange it so that it's 50%, 50%, half the time it'll transmit, half the time it'll reflect. So, and if you put, say, photodetectors on either end, so you put a little photodetector on the transmission, photodetector on the reflection, and you call them, you know, detector A, detector B. So, and you run this loads and loads of times, what you find would be the, you know, the first time it might be detector A fires and it detects the photon went straight through. Second time it might be detector B. But it could also, you know, you keep on doing it, you get like A, B, A, A, B, B, A, B, A, 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 B, B, A, A, B. You know, it's a random sequence. And if you did this a million times, you'd get, you know, 50% would be A, 50% would be B. But you can't ever tell what the next one is going to be in the sequence. You know, it could be A or it could be B. And that's as good as you can do. You actually can't do any better than that. So there's this element of randomness and freedom based in the fundamental particles of the universe, which makes up everything else, that they're not actually determined by their previous state. So this freedom to go to A or to go to B is present from the same starting conditions. So there's the universe somehow, in a particular run of this experiment, comes up with an output, comes up with an answer that you can't predict and is not dependent on any previous history either. It's a new invention of the universe that you know, detector B goes off this time. So it's basically the you could say that the universe is making itself up as it goes along, you know, as it goes through all of this process. So you can't predict the future with 100% accuracy. Now, you still might be able to do all the mathematics and all the equations and all the formulas, work it all out. You might get something happens 99.99999% of the time, but then it won't happen 0.00001% of the time. So, you know, in the past, people just thought, okay, there's something wrong with my experiment, you know, something funny happened, I don't worry about that. But now we know it's actually built into the laws of physics, the laws of the universe, that this randomness happens. And that gets everywhere. So once it happens for, you know, one particle, it happens for all particles. So they're basically all making up what they're doing all the time as we go along. And there's no absolute causality anymore in quantum mechanics. And it also means then that you can't actually look backwards in time with 100% certainty either. Because if you have some set of conditions now that you're looking at, and you think, how did it get this way? Well, you can't say that either, because there was always a randomness along the way, and you can actually get different starting conditions end up in the same ending condition. So it works, you know, in some senses it works both ways. So you start off in the same condition with your little light source, you can get detector A or B, so that's going into the future. And you can, you know, one state can go into a choice of two states. But it also works in backwards as well. So even if you have the one state now, and you look, how did it get here? It could have got here from different places too. So what you're left with to do is you can say something must have happened to within 99.99999999% probability, and you say, okay, I'll bet, put my money on it, you know, I'll bet. Because it basically becomes like a betting game, you know. You can do a bit of, you know, you can, in the photon experiment, you can bet on detector A or detector B. And if it was a different setup with a different piece of glass, you know, it was 90% A and 10% B, you know, you'd say, I'll put my money on A. You wouldn't be sure it's going to pay off, that bet. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it might make a bit of sense to do that. But also going back in the past, you're not necessarily guaranteed to know, you know, anything, exactly what happened in the past. And this randomness, the other thing it does, because it gets everywhere, because it's involved with all particles at all times, basically. There's the question, like, you know, did history have to be the way it progressed? The answer's obviously no. If you wound back the world 1,000 years, you know, and ran that experiment again, you know, you start off from 1,000 years ago and you say, how are things going to progress in time? They would for sure come out different. That's basically guaranteed, because if you look at all your probabilities, they, to some extent, these small little, one little particle doesn't count for much. But if you're doing billions and billions of particles, and they're all doing their random thing, it does actually build up to, you know, human scale and planet scale effects. This was also basically proven in the 1970s with the weather.
Okay.
So the weather is a chaotic system. And when the first computers were, you know, being built, some guy was putting in some equations into the punched card computers they had in those days to try and calculate some equations he had to describe the weather. And he found out if you put in an error in some decimal place somewhere, you know, you're trying to put in your parameters of, you know, what's your temperature, what's your wind, what's your pressure, air pressure today, and you find what's going to happen tomorrow. Any tiny little error, because he was doing this on punch cards, actually produced a different result within a week. So you get completely different weather forecast, you know, from being it's a nice sunny day to being it's a stormy thunderstorm with rain all day. Very different. And that's on the scale of, you know, a week or two for the weather. But it also, the point being, it was then analysed mathematically. It doesn't matter how far down the decimal places you're accurate. It's always going to be, it's a chaotic system, which means those little tiny little errors, they actually make macroscopic effects in a short space of time. Mm-hmm. And then somebody else, I think, did some calculation of, you know, billiard balls on a billiard table, because that's a fairly chaotic system, because the angles that the balls bounce off can be give very different results very quickly for small little changes of, you know, positions and velocities of the balls. Mm. And he was found within, I don't know, 15 collisions or something, you can get up with completely different arrangement of your billiard balls on your billiard table. Mm-hmm. And that was coming from an error down at the atomic level. So these tiny little errors, they actually easily multiply up into the world we see. Mm-hmm. So you could then think of historical events like, you know, the Armada sent from the King of Spain to invade Britain or something, and gets washed up in a storm somewhere off the coast of Ireland. But that storm, where did that storm come from? You know, that could have been affected by some random quantum results from the previous week, you know?
Absolutely.
So these events are, you know, they're more than random. They have to be random. Or was it King Harold who got the arrow in the eye?
Right.
You know, you could say, well, if the gust of wind had been a little bit different as the arrow was flying, it would have missed his ear or something, you know. And so that could have been affected, or was affected, by all the little quantum fluctuations the previous week. So you've got, you know, historically significant effects from that. You've also got other ones you can come up with, which is just, you know, the thoughts in your head. You know, what's your brain doing?
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to, you know, have a battle and you're thinking, oh, I could go this way or I could go that way, you know, with my army, and it's a, you know, split-second decision or something, that, you know, what state was your brain in at the time? It could have had some little random fluctuation, could have flicked it into the other state and it would have changed the course of history again. So all of those effects, you know, they really do build up into the real world effects we see all the time, even though we wouldn't necessarily realise it. So that would be one way that, you know, the randomization of the world, you know, could have all sorts of differences. And it also means then the future is not determined. So I thought sometimes about free will. That's another.
Okay.
It's another topic.
Indeed.
I came up with the result that there is freedom and there is will. I don't know. I don't know what free will is, but the freedom is there in the laws of nature, quantum mechanics again, and the will is the things you want, like, you know. You must eat your broccoli. No, I don't want to eat my broccoli. You must eat your broccoli. No, I don't want to eat my broccoli. So, I mean, will definitely exists. And you can say that's subject to laws and, you know, your upbringing, your physical state. It could be a part of that, you know, the laws of the universe at work. But then there is also the freedom, which also exists. And these two both, they both exist somehow together. But it does mean the future is not determined. So that's another implication that one gets.
You mentioned that in quantum mechanics, the view of things is from the point of view of a single person. Mm-hmm. So each time it's the view of one, and we don't get a sense of the view of all. Well, in a way, this is true also of our view of the past. Mm-hmm. So my way of looking at it is probably going to be different from your way of looking at it, and it's certainly going to be different from many of my readers' way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. So we are also dealing with this sort of multiplicity of perspectives. Mm-hmm. And yet, there continues to be this conviction that somehow, some way, we will arrive at some absolutely concrete understanding of something that happened in moment X, in place Y, and it was done by people PQR. Mm-hmm. However, this is precisely the sort of knowledge that probably is slightly precarious. Mm-hmm. Because, first of all, how can we verify that a certain set of circumstances actually occurred in a particular moment in time, if we can't grasp that moment?
Quite. Yeah, so the lessons, I'd say, from physics in those directions are that so there's, in quantum mechanics, again, I'll be referring to this often, you have to be very careful what you say. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very careful about what you know and what you don't know. And it was found that there are things, basically, you can't know, so don't even try. So the famous one of those is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So you have a particle, say it's an electron, and it's approximately going in this direction, approximately at that velocity, but there's an uncertainty in both of those. You know, it might be a little bit left or right, or it might be a little bit faster or slower. You can't. It's literally impossible to know both of those things at the same time. And yet you still talk about, you know, the position of the electron, you still talk about the velocity of the electron. But you have to remember that they're not really very precise statements. And if you get too, prejudiced about, you think you know where it is, well, it's just not going to be true. But then you're saying, well, how do you know when you're finding out something in the past? Because you're not looking at it anymore. So the only thing there is you can get as much of that information as you possibly can. So while you're not looking at something, you don't have that information. It's not going to affect your calculation of your probabilities or your estimations of what's happening. And then when you do get information, you update your probabilities. Oh, there's a new bit of information. But there's a little bit of subjectivity there, because maybe you don't really believe it, that you think, oh, that guy was lying in 1843 or something when he wrote that down. It was only he was trying to make a bit of money. He wasn't trying to make sure it was the right statement. So you've got some ignorance in how you assess, you know, what somebody else has said. But the best you can do then is just to get all the information that you can from as many sources as you can. And you then try and reconstruct, well, what was the most likely thing that occurred that gave rise to all of this information that I do have? And that's basically, without building a time machine, mm-hmm. as good as you can do. And it's not going to get you 100%. Some things you think are going to be fairly well settled, You know, so, I mean, a lot of people will agree that, you know, Harold got shot in the head with an arrow, you know. But you've then got to always have that element of humility that, well, it could be the 0.0001% might actually be what actually happened that everybody got wrong. So just because people agree to something certainly doesn't make it any truer. But then if you want to know yourself... Yeah, so that's the thing with quantum mechanics. You can only really know yourself what your the observed outcomes that you're observing are. So when I see detector A go off, I've got a bit of faith that that is a true signal coming to me. You know, otherwise you get into Descartes and, you know, everything's all a big lie or something, or virtual reality, and it could be random, it could be anything. But so the things that I take as being valuable could be, you know, what I see in front of me is obviously how I live my daily life. I'm taking that as valuable. But then you've got reports of other people, and they become dodgy because you don't know what they were knowing when they wrote that down or said it. So you then have to be very honest with your own ignorance that you don't know what they were thinking. And even if you think they're an honest guy generally, again, maybe there's that 0.01% probability that, oh, well, he lied this time. If you're digging up something out of the ground and you're doing archaeology, you've got an object. You've found an object. It's in your hand. It must mean something. It must have come from somewhere. That's valid, and that's true enough. But again, how you interpret that, you know, you want to fit it into this big jigsaw that you've made of the past. You know, you basically, it's a map. So that's another thing that comes very important in how to think about the world. You know, you've got a map of it in your head. And that's your subjective reality. You know, what you're really looking at is the map in your head. You're not really looking at reality itself. And yet reality seems to have this objective existence where, you know, things happen independently of you, and you could be right, you could be wrong about them. You could walk across a dark room and stub your toe because there was a table in the way that you weren't aware of. You know, there's some sort of objective reality, one could say, out there. But the only thing you see is your map of it in your head. And that's all the information that's come to you through your eyes and ears, and everything else has been reconstructed in your head to become a map of the world. So one's job in life, one could say, is to make this an accurate map. You know, if the map in your head corresponds to what happens in the world, you check them off each other. And I do experimental physics, so that's the type of thing I do. You know, I want some experiment to come out a certain way, but then I have to check in the lab, did it actually come out, you know, is it actually happening like that, or is there something I hadn't thought of? And more often than not, there's something you haven't thought of. So there's a lot of humility involved in what your own subjective view of the world is versus what it turns out to be. So you should always keep that, because there's no way around that. I mean, it just has to be built in to the nature of reality somehow. So the work I try and do is to make my map correspond as closely as possible to what I can see and how things work as far as I can see them, which is also how sort of physics puts it as well, is that when you want to say, you know, what's really happening in a quantum mechanics experiment, you find you're not allowed to say things. You know, you're not allowed to say the photon actually went from this place through that space to that place there. And because you didn't measure those things, you can't actually talk about them. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very careful with your own limitations and not saying too much or being too confident or But if you can come up with a set of statements which, when you compare it to all the world you see with all the evidence you've got and all your archaeology and all your history textbooks or texts, you know, from the time and later, and you come up with a picture that covers all of that and doesn't get into trouble anywhere, then that's basically as good as you can do. The problem is you could come up with a different one which could also cover all of that evidence and all of those facts, and it would look different than the first view of all of those evidences and facts. So the only way to distinguish between those is with more evidence. So then it becomes like a detective story. Say, what would distinguish between these two views of the world? And I'm going to go and look in the world and see if I can find it. So again, as an experimental physicist and someone who looks at data from experiments, that's the type of thing that I do as well, especially if an experiment doesn't come out the way you want. You know, you have to think, something's missing that I didn't think of. What could it be? So you end up with, you know, it could be hypothesis A or hypothesis B or hypothesis C. And then you think, well, how could I distinguish between those? I'll do another experiment now and I'll be able to say, I'll distinguish between hypothesis B and hypothesis C. And then you go and perform that and say, okay, well, C was ruled out basically. So I'm left with A and B, and maybe that's as good as I can do. I'll just carry on from there. But there's sort of no point in just focusing down on one bit of data, you know, because you can be misled by a small corner of the data, you know. If you have, I don't know a good example, but I find it anyway, that if you have, you know, evidences A, B, C, D and E, if you only look at D and E, you come up with a hypothesis that explains D and E. Mm-hmm. And you can fool yourself into thinking, well, my hypothesis must be true because D and E are perfectly explained. Therefore, I've made my map between my explanation and my found reality, and they match perfectly, and that's the way it's going to be. But unfortunately, you've ignored A, B, and C for whatever reason, and they come up with a different picture. And that might have a different general explanation, there'd be a different, you know, mapping of thoughts to the world. So this thing about, yeah, how to map your thoughts onto the world and not get into trouble is what we're left with from this subjective-objective split in the world. You know, we're seeing it from a subjective point of view. So the best you can do is get all the evidence you possibly can and come up with these big theories. And if you get new evidence, maybe it'll fit into your big theory. You get attached to these things. Maybe you want to hammer it in there with a hammer to make sure it fits, or else, you know, you're going to have to change the view of things. But everything should be up for change, mm-hmm. to within some certain little probability of, you know, even if you keep it at a 0.0001%, you should always keep that little opening to say, well, I'm not actually certain because I don't have all the evidence. I don't know everything. I wasn't there. And you're never going to... Basically, I don't think it's the... Is it even the point to get to 100% certainty? It sort of feels good to say, I know this. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the end of the story. But I'm not absolutely sure is that even really where we should go as a species, or, you know, as a view of the world, because the world, from the quantum mechanics point of view, always has these little uncertainties everywhere that creep in everywhere, and they happen because even something with a 0.001% probability to happen will happen if you run the experiment a million times. You know, if something only happens once every 100,000, you know, goes of an experiment, and you run it 10 million times, it's surely going to happen. You know, it's just going to be the way it is.
But what about the distinction between a fact and a theory?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what you're saying suggests that an absolute 100% factuality of a thing is difficult to establish. Then what is the best what would you call the best that we can arrive at? We're not going to call it a fact, are we? Or are we going to call it a verified theory? A theory that's been proven and discussed and
yes.
held to be true by many, many experts for a long time.
Yes, well, I mean, again, there's lessons to be learned from physics here. For example, I was saying there's the general relativity and there's quantum field theory. So they're the two best theories of physics at the moment. But it's known that neither of them are the final theory because they don't have each other in them. You know, so quantum mechanics doesn't do relativity, well, not general relativity. General relativity doesn't do quantum mechanics. And yet you can do quantum mechanical experiments and they come out according to how quantum mechanics says, and you can do general relativity experiments and they come out to how general relativity goes. And they both, basically, both of those replaced Newtonian physics and classical physics. So from 1500s up to 1900. So between like, you know, the 1500 to 1900 period, you know, 1700s and the 1800s, you've got, in physics, these are the best theories that we've got. And as far as they knew, they had no counter arguments to them. So Newton's laws of motion were, everyone was happy with those, and electromagnetism, everyone was happy with those. But it turns out that all got replaced in the early 1900s. And now we've got the replacement theories. We know they have to be replaced because they don't contain each other, and yet the world works in these ways. So you might say the best guess at the moment is string theory, which is quantizes. You get general relativity for free in a quantum theory. Instead of having little point particles and an electron being a point, you just make it a little wiggly line, tiny, tiny one, but one-dimensional, not zero-dimensional. If you do that, then you get relativity for free. And so physicists were saying, OK, we'll go and look at that then for the next 50 years. They haven't finished yet, but... and they even say, well, we don't, you know, proven it's right yet either, you know, even the whole approach. It's certainly promising, but it's always this provisionality to it,
mm-hmm.
that even if they do get to what they call the final, you know, theory of physics, which they haven't done yet, it's still provisional on not finding something else that you didn't think of. You know, there's the whole question about, you know, how does consciousness work, or experience work? You know, is that going to have an effect on physics, or is that just some afterthought type of superfluous stuff that, you know, you can see the colour red, but an electron doesn't care? Or you're going to have to actually change physics again and say that, well, these things do have an effect. You know, if you see the colour red versus blue, then maybe it does tell the electron what to do. I don't know. You know, physicists tend not to think about that as being too far out in the future, but it might come to that one day. Just to say that there's a provisionality to it. Even if you've explained all you've got to explain up to the moment, you know, what else is there? Well, you don't know what else is there, so you have to keep yourself open to those things.
Let's move in a slightly different direction to the question of time.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience of time that we have as persons, and where this sits in the larger context of sort of scientific explanations of time. Because, for instance, we have an everyday sensation of the passage of time.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have lifelong experience of aging. Some people age. And we also have what we think is evidence of a past time, perhaps before ours, which belonged to the experience of other humans. So we think of time as being a succession of presence, in a way,
mm-hmm.
of a succession of moments in which we have lived and other individuals have lived. It's limited, of course, by our own relatively short lifespans in the general scheme of things. So we are concerned with things like seconds and minutes and hours and days and weeks and so on. It's sort of human history is relatively new as far as we're able to understand it. Certainly 10,000 years ago, we have very little idea of what was going on in humanity, even though we know humans existed. But beyond that, these much larger periods and much larger spans that physics is interested in, it may have something to say about time that eludes our perception, that eludes our apprehension and our daily understanding of time as being a succession of presence. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so time... So the of the two theories of physics, relativity and quantum mechanics, so relativity sort of says the most about time. And what it says is it does divide the world and everything in it into a past, present and future. However, you also have to take into account the observer, so as in you yourself, you know, me. And quantum mechanics says this too, you only see the world from your point of view. And the experiences that you have can be different than the experiences somebody else has. So, for example, in time, there's the twin paradox is a famous thought experiment by Einstein, where he was saying there's two twins and they're born together, the same age, grew up together. One of them goes off in a space rocket into outer space, you know, at fairly high velocities, and then comes back to Earth. So he finds that the twin who stayed on Earth aged much more. So the guy in the rocket, you know, he aged something because he went on a trip and it took some time. So he might have done that in 1 year, for example, whereas the twin on Earth might have aged 10 years or 100 years, depending on how fast the other guy was going. So the twin who went off into outer space and came back again could come back and find his twin brother had been dead for 20 years of old age. So the experience of time is definitely depends on, in that case, your motion through the universe. So, for example, if I go towards you and I go away from you, well, say I go towards you again, I've now aged slightly less than you have. So that's something you wouldn't expect.
No, indeed.
And you'd say that sounds a bit crazy, but... basically, you know, again, these physics experiments have been done and, you know, they got to such an amplified effect where you can easily measure these things. So there's the experience of time. So that's still in the present. You know, I'm always in the present, you know, and you feel like you're always in the present. But my present might be moving slower than your present might be moving. Something like this. There's also the case of what's simultaneously, what's now mean in relativity. And that's basically related to the speed of light being a limiting constant of the universe, that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. Information can't travel faster than the speed of light. So if I'm seeing the world now, all this, you know, information is coming to me, it took some time to get there. So in that sense, I'm seeing things as they were a little bit in the past, but only a tiny bit. So in this room, you know, there's a few meters across. That might take a few nanoseconds of time, you know, which is a thousandth of a millionth of a second, for the light to get across the room to hit my eye. But anything that's happening on that wall in a 1 nanosecond back from now, I can't know about, because that's too fast. You know, that information can't have got to me yet. So that's taken as simultaneous to how I'm sitting here. So there's the further away something is, the longer there is a time of simultaneousness. But then, in terms of the whole planet, it takes, well, you have light can go around the whole the equator 7 times in a second. So on the scale of planet Earth, you know, you're still only talking, you know, a tenth of a second is you know, the sort of number that can get you around the world. So anything that happens in the last 1/10 of a second, maybe that's in my present in some sense. But anything further back than 1/10 of a second is in my past. So, and according to how, what velocity I'm going, what counts as being in my present and in my past changes as well. And this, again, is related to the speed of light. But if I move towards that wall very fast, then the wall behind me will have more time in its simultaneousness. You know, the light will take longer to sort of catch up with me, I suppose. But still, it's saying the past exists. It's mm-hmm. saying the present, in some sense of the word, exists, and the future is determined from the present. So the thing with relativity is everything is only laws. There's no randomness in relativity. So what was in the past will, you know, cause absolute succession of events into the present, and you can, you know, go backwards, you know, uniquely, one moment to the next, backwards in time. Whereas quantum mechanics won't let you do that. So it's saying more about you can't know stuff, you know, you can't really do 100% correlation backwards in time necessarily. You know, as soon as you don't know something, then that uncertainty sort of multiplies across everything that you do, and things just become more and more uncertain and more unknown. But both, so both relativity and quantum mechanics, they take the past as having existed. And to some extent, that's how we got here, you know, so the theories of physics in that sense are very, they just agree with your intuition of what the general picture of what time does. You know, so 1 million years ago, well, let's say 70 million years ago, there were dinosaurs on Earth. That's probably a true statement, and wouldn't particularly be adapted by, you know, quantum uncertainties or anything like that. You know, it's still taken as a fact. You know, if you dig up some fossils and you do all the carbon dating, well, not carbon, but radioactive dating, and you know, the layering in the Earth crust, you know, in this particular layer of rock that must have taken this long to have got covered over by these other layers of rocks. So again, you're adding up all your evidence as best you can, and you're saying that's the best picture I can do. So that's all you can ever really get to. It's the best I can do. And again, is that with that provisionality that something else might turn up that, you know, it's instead of my facts A, B, C, D, and E, maybe there's a fact F comes along and makes a mess of it all. And it was all aliens put it there to annoy us or something. Can't quite rule it out. Tiny, tiny probability.
Absolutely. Well, would it be fair to say then that we have a sense of time which is a sort of convenient fiction in a way? So this sort of malleability of the relation of movement to time and so on is something that we don't take into consideration when we're talking about how things are happening from day to day or from month to month.
Indeed.
And so, like so many other aspects of day-to-day life, we have a number of, let's say, working assumptions, which really sort of shortcuts to thought and shortcuts to behavior that really make make interaction and make life sort of possible. Does that make sense?
Almost totally. I think that's absolutely what we do. And so that's all about, is my map good enough?
Right.
So if in my head I've got this map of the world, so is that map good enough to go to the shop and get some lasagna? It is, you know. So as far as it works, I don't really care.
Right.
And you just get these impressions that sort of work. You know, I mean, you know, is the Earth standing still and the sun moves across the sky? Seems to work, you know. I mean, most of the time you don't get into trouble if you think like that. But is it true? Is it what the world really does? You know, is the Earth actually standing still and is the sun really moving? I mean, you could argue that it is, but you could argue that it isn't. And so long as you don't get into trouble contradicting something else, you know, you can live with it and you can go about your daily life and do your daily things. But if one was to ask, well, what way is the world really? The answer to that is sort of nobody knows still. So again, with going back to quantum mechanics being, you know, even more fundamental than relativity, is basically saying with all of these randomized outcomes, and, you know, nature chooses one outcome over the other outcome. You know, so nature's making itself up as it goes along. You know, this is seems to be doing it on a moment-by-moment basis, you know. And that, you know, so, well, do you care about that?
Exactly.
Yeah,
does it actually matter? Decisions from day
well,
to day,
not
from moment
not
to moment.
Particularly, no. Mm. But it could do if you were then to make, say, I don't know, it probably comes into morality, you know, ethics and philosophy, about what do you think a human is? You know, if a human's just a load of reactions, then, you know, how can I get you to react the way I want? And if your experience makes no difference to the world, then why can't I torture you? Mm-hmm. So one can quickly get into, you know, how one builds a picture of the world can then go into, at some stage, how you behave in the world. That could make big differences.
So the convenient fictions that we have about society, about ourselves, and where we fit, and what has to be done, and what is best not to do, are essential not just for ourselves, but they're essential for our communities to function and our cities are our countries. Convenient fictions are a reality in our lives.
And they are some sort of a... So I was saying about maps of how the world is, you know, as opposed to what's in my head, you know, trying to get them to match up. So there's also... where am I going with this one? Well, the convenient fictions... Oh, yeah, society. What we've all taken to... You know, live together with certain values. You know, I'm not going to rob your house. You know, most people think that. Some people don't. Some people are going to rob your house. But you find out, you know, over the course of the centuries and the millennia, you know, you've got different societies, you know, on a small scale in the past, and they've got bigger, you know, in more recent history, past couple of hundred years, you know, you start getting countries and then you get... You know, alliances between countries, and you get, you know, world organizations nowadays.
And this is where history comes in.
But what are we learning from history? Yeah.
Precisely.
Exactly. And so I've thought of... There's also the whole evolution of the human individual as well. You know, so I mean, as a body... You know, I didn't decide to have two arms. I was born with them, and I found out I had them at some point in my early childhood. I didn't make them that way, but somehow nature made it up as it went along over billions of years as to what, you know, works in inverted commas from, you know, survival point of view. And I always think in the past things were more brutal. You know, if you think of, you know, medieval Europe, where all the torturing and beheading and dungeons and...
Absolutely true.
Absolutely horrific as well. And you're saying, OK, well, we don't do that so much anymore. I mean, maybe a little bit somewhere in the world, I guess. But generally speaking, you think, OK, we did that. We sort of learned from it. You don't really want to do it again, you know. Because it was painful and brutal... And you don't like that, you know. So generally speaking, on average, again, all these individual exceptions, you know, you want a nice life, you want to enjoy yourself during the day, you want a bit of entertainment, bread and circuses, maybe you could say, but, you know, you just want things to go well. And
there has to be some pleasure.
That's a bit of some pleasure. So... You know, all the history up until now is an accumulation of the different ways that people have tried to make their life better in hard circumstances. So starving to death is unpleasant. So people built farms, and then even when you had farms, you'd get diseases and droughts and you'd still die. So you'd develop storehouses and you'd try and... develop your farmland into different areas and work out irrigation so you don't starve. So all of these little things, they, you know, they add up over the centuries. It takes, you know, thousands of years to figure it all out. And to some extent, we've accumulated all of that into the present, you know, whether we think of it explicitly or not. Because if you think of, you know, the ancient Egyptians or whatever troubles they were having back then with droughts and famines and wars and diseases, you know, they still left behind their impressions to the Greeks and to the Middle Easterns and to the Romans and to themselves. And even if you forgot everything they did and the hieroglyphics weren't there and the pyramids got destroyed, that effect is still percolated throughout society, even if forgotten. And we build this up. So in the two ways, the explicit way is to, like, learn history and learn about the ancient Romans and learn about, you know, medieval torture and, you know, learn these things explicitly.
It's if we didn't do that, we would truly live in a random world.
Well, yeah. But the thing is, there's also the effects that living through that had still go on even if you don't write it in a book, I think. Mm-hmm. There's still...
It's imprinted in the mental DNA, maybe.
Something like that. Yeah, mm-hmm. There's some sort of carryover. Mm-hmm. That is implicit. It's implicit in the world we live in. You don't necessarily see it explicitly. But
is it because it's verbalized?
Well, it's because it's verbalized as you see the explicit bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm just saying that's not the only bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a biological bit.
Well, there's
I'm sure
that.
The species has changed mm-hmm. in these 10,000 years.
There's
30,000 years, whatever.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, there's definitely a small amount.
Mm.
Whether that's in any particular good direction or not is actually hard to say, because the way evolution goes from, say, crude animals to more refined animals, let's say, is through death. Mm. And... So there's nature, you know, throws up variations, which again is randomness. And that's even quantum randomness, because DNA mutations is chemistry. Chemistry is determined, you know, which molecule actually literally interacts with the next molecule. There is a random choice there
mm-hmm.
that it's not compulsory for two atoms to bond together. They might just bounce off each other and not bond together. So whether two, you know, molecules bond or not, there's again the random number generator of quantum mechanics comes in and says, okay, you can do it this time, and then they do it, or it'll say no luck this time, they just bounce off each other and go somewhere else. So genetic mutations are, you know, the quantum randomness is definitely in there, which then also allows for, you know, decay and degradation and disintegration going back into randomness,
mm-hmm.
you know, like why do we have structure in the world even, versus why isn't it just a mess of soup?
Mm-hmm.
But the self-organizing parts, you know, they keep going, because that's, you know, by definition they're the ones that continue, and by the fact that they've continued. It's basically they still, you know, they can shed off useless bits, but they still generate the continuous, you know, ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose some species can go extinct, so, you know, it's not a compulsory, you know, law of the universe that just because something is working well now, it's going to continue that way. You know, maybe it's, again, conditions change and it all goes to hell. that's possible. But at the same time, whatever happened in the past does have an effect into the future. So, again, the laws of physics, both in relativity, is the compulsory laws of propagation from the past into the present, into the future. Whereas quantum mechanics, there's still laws. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a bit of randomness added in, but there's definitely laws of the past goes into the present. And then, you know, you're generating the future, but you're still with some equations behind it and probabilities to say it's more likely to go this direction than a different direction. So I think because humans want to live better lives, so long as they want to do that, I think society will get better, actually.
Mm. That's a nice thought.
Yeah, well, indeed. So until that desire goes away, then, you know, if nobody cares if society gets better or not, then, well, maybe it will get worse. Mm. So because it'll just be, again, it'll be back to random drift, you know, and it'll randomly drift until it hits an iceberg or stubs its toe against a table in the dark. And then it'll say, "Oh, actually, I didn't want to do that. Let's get back to doing something better."
So, isn't it a question then of understanding what the consequences of mm-hmm. doing one thing or another thing
mm-hmm.
are going to be? And the more these experiences have occurred, just as in your neighborhood, the more experiments have been made, that show effects in one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
The same in our human past.
Mm-hmm.
The more experiences are accumulated of what is necessary for a stable society to exist,
mm-hmm.
what limits should there be on people's behavior, what kinds of social structures function better than other kinds of social structures. Do we actually need countries? Things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Or would we be if there were no nations, would there be no a convenient form of organization to enforce the codes of behavior that make life and the economy and society move in a mm-hmm. sort of direction that gives more benefits to a larger number of people.
Mm.
So it's a sense of experience and sense of knowing something about those hazards
mm-hmm.
that makes it possible to sort of continue to progress in your definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, I see all of the human societies, they're all experiments because nobody knows what's best. So obviously some people have an idea and they say, do what I say because I know what's best. But I think they don't know what's best. No, nobody does. I don't. I mean, I don't think anybody else does either. So the way I see that working is there are a whole lot of experiments going on. So you've got different communities in different areas and, you know, they can make up their own rules and they can live the way they want. And, you know, they can see how they get on. You know, do they do well? Do they not do well? And they're also neighbours to other groups who are trying another experiment. So how do they border each other? You know, is one going to be unstable with respect to the neighbour? You know, it would be okay on its own, but because you've got some big nasty neighbour who wants your territory, then you're not so
mm-hmm.
you're not so well adapted to your environment. But in general, I would say what I like about the way the world is structured at the moment, if I may say that, is you've got the different cities. So they've got different city councils, you know, and they basically, you know, they look after their own little area and they you know, collect the garbage in different ways or... You know, they've got different parking rules on the streets and they can you know, do that if they want. And you've got, you've got the counties bigger than that and they're, you know, taking care of the potholes and producing roads between the cities that they want connected. Another county council somewhere else might be doing another set of priorities over there. They might be more into, nature conservation because they've got a big forest that they need to take care of, whereas the other guys didn't, you know. There's different circumstances in different places. So you do different things depending on what you see as the need at the moment. And then you've got the different countries. So, you know, you've got different political parties and they've all got their own priorities and they try out some different things and they're all experiments because I don't believe any of them know what's right, to be honest. And you've got different countries then which are doing their own thing and they've got their own traditions. So if one country's got one traditional way of going about stuff, that's fine by me, and another country's got another tradition, you know, from all of their history that they've learned their lessons. That's their evidence that they've taken from their history as to what's the best way to run things, and, you know, good luck to them. So I see this as great, you know, lots of people doing lots of different things in order to find out and learn, well, what ways work and what ways don't. And I think it would be ridiculous to say they all work as equally well as each other. I've never understood anybody who ever had that sort of approach to it.
Well, what about this question? Yeah. So, you were saying before that the we have the sense of a universe that's reinventing itself
mm-hmm.
every nanosecond. It's constantly in transformation. And we have a human community that's also in evolution, as we say,
mm-hmm.
In constant movement and change and so on. In the human community, it's pretty easy to see what some of the sort of basic trajectories are thought to be anyway. So, as you pointed out, a better life, more harmony, more prosperity, those sorts of things are always in view. Certainly they come up in political discussions. One could say that the human community is attempting to improve itself in one way or the other. What about the rest of the world? So, we have a universe and a world that is proceeding through history, is hurtling through history, just as the humans are hurtling through history. The humans have this purpose. What about the purpose of the rest? What's going on there? Why, so where is the universe going?
Uh-huh. Well, indeed.
And are these two
connected
or are they at odds?
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of wanting to go somewhere, I would say it's clear that humans have wants. How that works, I don't know. Sometimes I try and trace these things back to, again, physics and the nature of the universe, in the sense that a human body, at least, you know, is whatever, 60 to 80 kilograms or however much you weigh, made out of carbon and water and hydrogen and all of these elements which are physical. And they obey the laws of the universe the same as everything else obeys the laws of the universe. And yet, we also seem to have wants, which a physicist wouldn't really know what to do with. As to how, what is, yet, anyway, at least. But certainly I'd say at the moment, don't know what that is. So I'd have to switch over to say, to look at it from a more human-centric point of view as to where we should be going. But at the same time, humans didn't exist 100 million years ago, not as humans. I mean, they were some sort of either mammal or pre-mammal or whatever they were, you know, rat, basically, back in those days. So did the universe exist for that rat to evolve into a human? Would seem a bit of a claim. But then there's consciousness. So again, there's the whole issue about how does consciousness work in the world? Does it actually do anything? Because we like to think that I can do something. And nobody's figured out what that means yet. How that's possible. So we've got the universe, well, from quantum mechanics point of view, you've got this random number generator, which is deciding what happens next, is one way to think about it. And if one was to consider that in more detail, well, let's, because the laws of quantum mechanics get studied all the time, there's equations and you solve the equations and it's all maths, and we know how to solve maths. But then you've got this random number generator, which sort of comes in and decides what actually happens. And all the maths is doing is giving you the probabilities of, you know, the different possibilities of something happening. They're not actually telling you what happens. So this random number generator, if you were to take it seriously and say there's something about the universe that's doing this, you know, enforcing these outcomes, then you say, well, it's not connected to the, it's not the particle itself deciding what it's doing. You know, it's not sort of local to the particle. So an electron isn't deciding to appear over here on this detector. You can say that because of quantum entanglement, where particles share properties, but they could be, you know, a million kilometers apart. And yet, when the random number generator makes its decision, you know, these outcomes are correlated to each other. So it's not just local to one particle. You know, there's something that's spanning across time and space that's producing these outcomes. And it's not determined by any other particles in the vicinity of it, because it's the random number generator is by definition a free choice within a probability distribution of choices that it can make, but it's an absolutely free choice. It's not dependent upon the past. So it's not dependent on any particles at all then, and yet it acts on particles and determines how they behave and what they do. So it's like this thing, it's not material because it's not made out of particles, it's not in time and space because it spans time and space, and yet it determines the outcome of everything. So one could call it omnipotent in that regard. Everything in the world that ever has existed has been subject to this random number generator producing that particular outcome. But also because it's random, you couldn't say that it had desires or it wanted things to go in a certain way. But yet people, I mean, there's some discussions, it's a bit fringe, I suppose, but as to when, you know, there's the random number generator makes this choice somehow, there's a little bit of consciousness associated with that. That's how knowledge happens. That's how there's some experience to that. And this, yeah, because everything that you experience must have passed through this random number generator, must have activated at some point for you to experience anything at all. So maybe it and consciousness are somehow interconnected. It's not clear how that works. But because it determines the outcome of everything in the universe, you start to then speculate, well, maybe it could sort of bias things a little bit in one direction it wants. You know, maybe it has a desire that it wants things to be a certain way. Now, you run into trouble very quickly with that, because you end up breaking special relativity, which is the other part of physics, unless you can find a way to get around that too. But this whole thing about the, you know, the purpose of the universe, or the universe wanting an outcome, physics hasn't got to what that could possibly mean in any clear way.
But what about these systems theories, which talk about, for instance, so biology is a system, or the living things are part of a system, and perhaps the tendency of that system is self reproduction and also self protection in a way. Now, is that something that one could apply to the universe as a whole? I mean, if we're saying humans are in some ways looking to their own improvement, or whatever is the kind of generalization that we want to make, one would think the universe is not necessarily the same thing, but what about the concept of self-protection or self-preservation?
Well, absolutely. So, I mean, you could say one thing the universe wants to do is increase entropy. I mean, that's... I don't know if there's a thing about it, is it a want or is it just something that happens? And, you know, there's... So if things start in a low entropy state, they're going to end up in a high entropy state. And on the way to that going into a high entropy state, there's little... You can get little circulations, like little eddy currents, which are, you know, semi-permanent vortexes in the world, which have some time span where it looks like there's... I mean, that was one of the analogies I sort of liked, is that, you know, we're all like little whirlpools in a stream. You know, there's a big random flow of water, and, you know, maybe there's some rocks in there and the water just whirls around, and you get something that looks stable for a while until it doesn't, and then it dies and carries on. And what carries on then is what you see in the future.
Of course.
So whatever has a long time span is something that you can you'll see around you. Mm-hmm. And if it can spin off another thing with a long time span, like a child, then you'll see that in the future. So these are processes that are allowed while entropy is increasing. And the worry then is, well, maybe entropy will max out, in which case all living things will die. Because there'll be... You have to sort of take advantage of a difference in entropy in order to do anything, like have a conversation or go for a walk. You're always...
How do you mean by that?
Well, you're taking a low entropy situation, like what I ate for lunch, and turning it into a high entropy thing, like the heat of my breath while I'm talking, is a high entropy mess. And you have to have something that allows you to be able to do that. So you have to have a low entropy and a high entropy difference. And then while you're converting one to the other, you can make your breath make a nice sound and make a sentence.
Right.
And then after that, the sound travels around a bit, bounces off the walls, and just turns into a random just bit of heat. And then it's at its highest entropy. And the universe is happy with that, you know? And we're happy in the meantime, because we've had a nice chat in the middle. But the other funny thing about that is the expansion of the universe. So in an expanding universe, you could say that there's more and more entropies allowed in the universe as it expands, because there's more room for chaos. So it's not quite so clear that we're all going to die in the you know, when the sun blows up in 8 billion years time, and maybe we've gone to a different star system, but then that star system will blow up in another few billion years time, and then the whole galaxy is going to die in a cold death. So one could argue, well, what's life all about anyway? You know, I mean, ultimately, in another 100 billion years from now, we're all going to be dead in more ways than one. There's not even any going to be any descendants. So is that
somebody could life worry about that?
Well, I worry about it myself in an odd moment. But to say, well, you know, is life the purpose of the universe when it's going to kill it all again? So is that really its purpose? You can't say, you know, humans are the purpose of the universe and then it's going to kill you all. I mean, unless...
Right.
I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
As a function of the universe. But at the same time, maybe the universe expanding will allow little pockets of entropy to still be exploited, where you can still get differentials of entropy, and life will carry on in those little areas where it's possible. But on the whole, I mean, obviously science has taken the universe to be a cold, harsh place that will kill you as fast as it'll be nice to you. You know, humans over their history have been, again, fighting the famines and the starvation and the wild animals, and everyone's been killing each other and fighting for food, as far as we can tell, from the year one.
Mm-hmm.
But
the universe is not going to be any nicer to us than we have been to each other.
No, but we are getting to the stage where maybe we can be nice. And that we're living in a little bit of luxury where you can go to the supermarket and there's food there.
Right.
You know, thanks to all human organisation and productivity and, you know, supply chains, all these types of things people have figured out. And all of these things are allowed by the universe because they happen in the universe. So maybe humans can exploit these little pockets of allowed circumstances to make it nice for ourselves.
As we move forward.
As we move forward, indeed. And that these are all then implicit in the laws of physics, because we're not doing anything that's against the laws of physics by doing that. So if they're the laws of physics, then maybe this is what the universe does want to do.
And on that positive note, thank you very much for your observations, and for this conversation. Let's stop the recording.
Okay, thank you so much.
Hoping I stop it the right way.